Israeli forces shot dead a displaced person near Khan Yunis city. According to UNICEF, an average of nearly 2 children get killed in Gaza every day since the ceasefire took effect in October. There is at least 67 children killed, with dozens more injured. Israel's genocidal war since October 2023 has claimed the lives of over 69,500 Palestinians. Our correspondent in Deir al-Balah, Moti Abu Musab, has provided us with further details on Israel's ceasefire violations across the war-ravaged Gaza Strip.
Israeli occupation forces proceeded to demolish and detonate more residential buildings in the eastern side of the central area of Gaza Strip, particularly Jahr al-Dik area. In the meantime, more Palestinian residential buildings were detonated in the eastern side of Az-Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City, and the situation is still alike and the same in the northern part of Gaza Strip, where the Israeli occupation forces have detonated several COVID-trapped robots in those areas. And even when it comes to the southern part of Gaza Strip, the Israeli occupation forces are still intensifying their attacks against various parts of the eastern section of Khan Yunis city, including Beni Suhaila area. There, they have destroyed several residential buildings. In the meantime, the Israeli artillery continued to strike those areas incessantly. We are still able to hear several explosions booming and echoing in those areas as a result of the incessant attacks against those areas. It's noteworthy that the Israeli regime is still trying to impose new realities on the ground by continuing their attacks from air, land and sea against the areas located beyond the so-called yellow demarcation line in the eastern side of Gaza Strip. But unfortunately, as you know, the Israeli regime is still ongoing with its policy of continuing those attacks to include even various parts of Gaza Strip located in the western side of that yellow line. So this reflects how perilous and serious the situation is for those Palestinian people.
The Israeli forces continue their deadly raids across the occupied West Bank, killing a young Palestinian southwest of Nablus city and injuring another person. The Israeli army announced that during its operations in the West Bank, more than 60 Palestinians were detained. Among those arrested was a Palestinian journalist who was passing through the town of Hawara, south of Nablus. Earlier, two Palestinian teenagers were killed in a raid by Israeli forces on the town of Kafar Aqab near occupied Al-Quds. Three others were also injured during the raid. Meanwhile, the Israeli settlers have set fire to a car parts yard near Nablus. The blaze destroyed dozens of vehicles and caused significant damage. Since October 2023, more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed in attacks carried out by Israeli forces and settlers across the West Bank. Our West Bank correspondent Naka Hamad joined us earlier with an update on the latest attacks against Palestinians by Israeli forces across the occupied territory. Let us take a listen.
Let me start by the announcement by the Palestinian Ministry of Health of the martyrdom of the Palestinian Yunus Walid Mohammed Shtayyeh, 24 years old, in the village of Til to the south of occupied Nablus in an assassination operation which has been implemented by special forces that filtrated into the village of Til. Later to this filtration, another supporting unit of the Israeli forces have raided till and closed the entrances and besieged the entire area of the confrontation between the late Yunus Shtayyeh and the raiding IOF forces. For several hours, Yunus was injured and left on the ground, as the videos clearly show. He was left on the ground bleeding until he passed away. The Israeli forces detained his body and announced that they will not be handing in his body towards the Palestinian side. Another attack happened into the provenance of Nablus, which since yesterday there has not been a quiet time in Nablus, as the Israeli forces continues their raid upon the city, Nablus city, especially in Askar refugee camp, detaining many Palestinians, attacking homes, ransacking homes, and according to local resources, of course, firing tear gas canisters and live ammunition.
The Israeli regime has carried out a new strike on Lebanon, violating the ceasefire with a drone attack on a vehicle in the country's south. Lebanon's health ministry confirmed that one person was killed in the strike in the town of Fraun. Earlier, the ministry announced that more than 300 people have been killed and nearly 1,000 injured since the ceasefire deal with Israel in November 2024. The deal requires regime's full withdrawal, yet Israeli forces remain in Lebanon's territory. Lebanese officials called this a violation of UN Resolution 1701. Prime Minister Nawaf Salam says Israel refuses to enter talks to end the occupation. The UN peacekeepers report that more than 7,500 airspace breaches and 2,500 ground violations north of the Blue Line. They also say 360 weapons left behind by Israeli troops were handed to the Lebanese army. Political analyst and military expert Ali Hamia says Israel has repeatedly violated the UN Resolution 1701 with more than 7,000 breaches, while Lebanon has fully complied.
We know that according to 1701 violation, Israel has violated this resolution more than about 7,000 times. And Lebanon fully comply with this resolution. And even the president, Lebanese president, has issued that we are ready since 27/11/2024 to go into negotiation in order to for Israel that gave us will withdraw from Lebanon within 60 days. Up to now, nothing happened. They accumulate. And they accelerate their aggression against Lebanon. Now they are like every week there is some violation going on against Lebanon. So they did not withdraw. They did not comply with the Resolution 1701. And they still committing assassination against the Lebanese civilian people.
In Italy, clashes erupted between police and protesters in the northern city of Bologna as thousands took to the streets to protest against the presence of an Israeli basketball team in the city. The police fired tear gas and used water cannons to disperse demonstrators who were chanting slogans in support of the people of Palestine and waving Palestinian flags. Protesters denounced the decision to hold a match between Virtus Bologna and Maccabi Tel Aviv in the city. They called for Israel to be suspended from international sports competitions. The demonstration comes amid growing anti-Israeli sentiments in the world over the regime's actions in Gaza, with activists urging a boycott of Israeli sports teams. In recent months, the participation of Israeli sports teams in European competitions has sparked protests in many cities. Yemen's health ministry is warning of a deepening humanitarian crisis as Sana'a International Airport remains closed. The facility was forced to shut down following Israeli airstrikes earlier this year. The ministry says the resulting health crisis is now affecting every family in Yemen. Abdul Latif al-Bashali reports from Sana'a.
Yemen's health minister Ali Shayban paints a stark picture of a health system suffocating under siege. Medicines are vanishing, chronic patients are deteriorating, children are dying before help can reach them. He called the shutdown of Sana'a International Airport a crime against humanity, especially after Israeli strikes destroyed its capacity, cutting off the only viable route for life-saving drugs. Families now face a brutal reality. No airport means no treatment, and no treatment means lives lost.
Today, we renew our call for the United Nations to operate flights and reopen Sana'a International Airport to save thousands of patients who urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. More than 250,000 patients require medical travel for serious and life-threatening conditions. Over 1,330 types of essential medicines, including immune therapies and other critical drugs, have not been allowed into the country due to the air blockade.
The ministry says thousands have been deprived of essential medications due to the air blockade. It warns that inaction would cause more deaths that can be simply prevented.
The continued closure of Sana'a International Airport clearly proves that the international humanitarian and health organizations that constantly preach about human rights are fully politicized and operate under American and Israeli influence. The clearest example is what is happening in Yemen, where thousands of people urgently need to travel for treatment but remain unable to do so as the airport remains closed to this moment.
Israel struck Sana'a International Airport in early May this year, damaging its runway, terminal, and several aircraft. The regime struck the facility again as Yemen continued its military operations against Israeli targets in response to its war on Gaza. Yemen's health ministry says the reopening of the airport, once a lifeline for the population, is an urgent humanitarian obligation, not a political convenience.
The health crisis continues to escalate as life-saving medicines remain blocked from entering the country. Officials warn that unless urgent steps are taken to restore medical access, thousands of vulnerable patients will face worsening conditions with no alternative options. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
Iran's foreign minister says the United States and European powers have assaulted diplomacy every step of the way and brought about the collapse of the Cairo agreement between Tehran and the International Atomic Energy Agency. Abbas Araghchi said despite Iran signing a deal with the IAEA in Cairo to resume inspections in the aftermath of US-Israeli aggression, the E3 pursued UN sanctions against Iran under US pressure. He added that when Iran began giving IAEA inspectors access to its unharmed nuclear facilities, the US and the E3 moved together to censure Tehran at the IAEA Board of Governors. Abbas Araghchi emphasized it is clear Iran is not the party seeking to manufacture another crisis, warning that the US and the E3 are seeking escalation. Earlier, Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei commented on the anti-Iran resolution adopted by the IAEA Board of Governors. He said it is a clear misuse of an international institution and undermines the agency's independence and credibility. The Russian Foreign Ministry also slammed the resolution as a serious blow to international trust in the IAEA. Russian President Vladimir Putin said Moscow has received US's peace proposals for Ukraine, adding that plan could form a basis for resolving the conflict.
We have this text of U.S. proposed peace plan. We received it through existing channels of communication with the U.S. administration. I believe it can be used as the basis of a final peaceful settlement, but it has not been discussed with us in detail, and I can guess why. The reason is the same. The U.S. administration has so far failed to secure Ukraine's consent.
Putin added that Ukraine rejected the plan and argued that neither Kyiv nor European powers grasped the reality of the Russian advances on the battlefield. He warned that without peace talks, Ukraine will inevitably lose more territory, like the recently captured city of Kupiansk. The Russian leader emphasized that while military operations continue to achieve Moscow's objectives, he remains open to negotiations. Putin said a peaceful resolution requires detailed discussions of the US proposals and that Russia is prepared to engage in such talks. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, on the other hand, says the country is facing one of the most difficult moments in its history, warning that Kyiv may be forced into a painful choice.
Right now is one of the most difficult moments in our history. The pressure on Ukraine is one of the hardest. Ukraine may face a very difficult choice, either the loss of dignity or the risk of losing a key partner, either the complex 28 points or an extremely harsh winter, the harshest, with further risks.
In an emergency address to the nation, the Ukrainian president also stressed that he won't betray his country's national interests. He said he will propose alternatives to the plan put forward by the Trump administration. A 28-point peace plan drafted by the U.S. has reportedly called for Ukraine to give up the entire Donbass region, limit the size of its military, and prohibit any foreign troop presence in its territory. The draft is also believed to suggest that the use of $100 billion of frozen Russian assets for a U.S.-led effort to reconstruct Ukraine. It rules out NATO membership for Kyiv while keeping the EU path open. The deal also demands snap elections for Ukraine in 100 days. The humanitarian crisis in Sudan is worsening with mounting death and a growing health emergency among civilians. Sudan's Doctors Network reported that 23 children in the cities of Diling and Kaduli have died within one month due to severe malnutrition. It also warned that the siege of Diling and Kaduli is endangering the lives of thousands of civilians. Meanwhile, the European Union has imposed sanctions on a senior leader of Sudan's paramilitary forces. The EU cited grave and ongoing atrocities committed by forces under Abdurrahim Dagalo's command during the more than two-year war with the Sudanese army. At the same time, the UN is pressing for access to the city of Al-Fashir, a famine-stricken city in Darfur. UNAID Chief Tom Fletcher said the city would be treated as a crime scene for investigations into systematic executions, detentions and rapes. And that is a wrap for this hour's news bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Go ahead and bring in our special guest. His name is Mossab. He is a journalist, and he is going to break down what is happening in Sudan. Let's go ahead and bring him in. What's going on, Mossab?
Hey, Sabrina. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining. This has probably been one of the most requested topics from viewers that watch the show. They do want someone to explain what exactly is happening in Sudan and if the U.S. is involved. So I want to start with this article here. For those who are not aware, this was reported recently that there was blood visible from space in Sudan. It says it shows evidence of the Darfur genocide. Now, I know, Mossab, you don't want to get, you know, too much, you know, into this, but it does point back to the genocide that is happening in Sudan. If you could please, first and foremost, explain to us, how did all of this begin?
So thank you for having me on, Sabrina. This basically started decades ago. I mean, the Sudan government for a long time, if you go back to the 70s, it was, you know, it was kind of coerced into joining the U.S. policy in the region. So it was used kind of as a weapon against Libya, against Chad, against Ethiopia, all at the time who had pretty much, you know, sovereign governments. They had their own internal problems. But essentially, Sudan was brought into that neoliberal fold. The government kind of did a U-turn in the 90s, and they, you know, claimed sovereignty, and they didn't want to follow the U.S. policy anymore. But they went in a very extreme direction of kind of, you know, supporting militant Islamist groups and, you know, hosting bin Laden and all that kind of stuff. And that got them on the radar for a regime change. In the late 90s, you know, the late Dick Cheney and his friends, the neocons, they put Sudan on the list of, you know, seven countries to be toppled in 5 years. You know, so it was on that list along with Iran and Syria and Libya and Iraq. But they kind of compromised with the U.S. and they let South Sudan separate to become its own country. So after that, then, you know, the Arab Spring came along, you know, Bashir got pretty shook by it. And he decided to go fully into the fold of the Gulf Arab countries and kind of under the fold of the UAE and Saudi Arabia and Egypt. The main thing that brings these countries together is that these are the countries that are allies of the U.S. and they're the ones that have a good relationship with Israel. You know, they might not, you know, outright have a lot of diplomatic relationships with Israel and everything, but that changed in 2020 with the Abraham Accords. But the struggle inside of Sudan has always been the problem of a fascist government in Khartoum. in Khartoum, the capital, for the last 40-plus years, there's been a fascist government, far-right extremist, you know, policies. You know, they claim sovereignty, but they work with the World Bank and put heavy austerity measures, privatizing large sectors of the economy. So they've been going along with that program, but kind of walking that step. Until 2014, that's when they joined it, fully into that fold of the Gulf Arab countries. Then in 2019, a popular movement sparked and, you know, removed Bashir. Once Bashir was out of the picture, the strong man who was kind of towing that line between the East and the West and everything, then it became kind of an open playing field for a lot of intelligence, you know, U.S. intelligence, Israeli intelligence, the UAE, Turkey, you know, people, because of the strategic location of Sudan and the amount of resources. You know, Sudan geographically is a place that connects North Africa with the Horn of Africa, East Africa, Central Africa, and the Sahel region. You know, if you look at Sudan and its geography, it connects all of these regions together. So historically, it was even like a superhighway of civilizations and of movement and of trade and stuff like that. And that's why it's always been on the U.S.'s radar as far as a place that has to be put, quote unquote, under control. This pressure, like neo-colonial pressure, led to the powers inside of Sudan, specifically the army and the RSF, vying for power. And not just political power, but economic power as well. And this is where countries like the UAE fully adopted the RSF. Now, those of you, your audience who are old enough, probably remember in the 2000s, the Save Darfur movement. You know, the genocide in Darfur. And people usually don't follow up to see, you know, what happened to that campaign, like what happened to that genocide. The genociders won. The Janjaweed militia actually was legitimized and became the RSF that we know today. And the European Union funneled money to them so that they can protect the borders and quell migration. You know, the UAE and Saudi Arabia recruited them so that they fight the Houthis, Ansar Allah, in Yemen. You know, so the RSF slowly became a country within a country. So they committed genocide in the 2000s. And then when Bashir was removed, they overthrew another civilian government. And then it became the question of, well, how can you have two armies in one country? You know, you can't have the official army SAF and you can't have the RSF side by side. There has to be a security structure, security sector reform. And that's where basically the old guard that were in SAF and the new guard that's in the RSF bumped heads, because none of them want to give up power. None of them want to give up the resources, the vast gold mines, the livestock, you know, all the political power that comes along with that. You know, the Red Sea, you know, so many different countries want ports on the Red Sea. That's also a part of it. Food security. For the Middle East, you know, Sudan has vast agricultural projects. But so all of these things kind of created the perfect storm. But it's still, I mean, you see in 2023 and 2024, Netanyahu brought out to the UN General Assembly a map that had the new Middle East. And it basically included the Gulf countries, Egypt, and Sudan. You know, so, you know, there was some criticisms in the beginning of the war. You know, people were like, you know, don't make everything about Israel. Well, you know, Sudan got pushed into this new Middle East map, and apparently all of the policies that were pushed on it were in lockstep with U.S. and Israel policy. And this just basically broke the country, because they propped up these criminal entities like the RSF and Bashir's party, the NCP, within, you know, controlling SAF. And, you know, one of the goals of this war is to kill any kind of sovereign citizen movement to move towards democracy and let go of these, you know, monopolies, these military monopolies on the Sudanese economy. There are other issues as well. You know, the Bashir regime for 40 years has been pushing an Islamo-Arab-centric policy and trying to make Sudan into one homogeneous, you know, identity of being Arabs and being Muslim. And this also made non-Arab Arabs within Sudan, indigenous groups, feel like they're second-class citizens. That's what led to the separation of South Sudan. It led to genocides in South Sudan, in Darfur, in the Nuba Mountains. So we have a lot of complex problems that were never solved, and everything was just pushed under the rug, and this is what led right now. But the genocide that's going on right now in Al-Fashir is kind of a continuation of a long, you know, track record of this central government basically trying to quell its citizens and coerce them.
So once again, Israel is involved. Skylar brings up a good point here. So they want Sudan as part of the new Middle East because Sudan has all the gold and farmland.
That's part of it, yes. But more importantly, so that Sudan doesn't become part of a resistant axis to U.S. and Israel policy. You know, Sudan is a country of 40 million people. You know, it's between it and Israel, there's only one country geographically, and that's Egypt. So the proximity, also the geographic proximity, is makes it so where that they want to make sure Sudan kind of is kept in check. And of course, part of it is also they don't want Sudan to be a solid ally with Russia or China or any one of the other competing countries with the West. So, yeah, I mean, there's a couple of reasons. The resources is part of it. And part of it is kind of geostrategic as well.
So we cannot stress this enough that once again, we have another conflict that Israel is a part of. I want to get your opinion about this, Masab. I have seen videos of people fleeing Sudan. When people are fleeing Sudan right now, those who are able to get out, where are they going?
So that's one of the biggest, the big tragedy right now is the magnitude of the war itself. Try to think about this. 12 million people displaced. 12 million people being displaced. Basically, the Sudanese, they went in all different directions. You know, there's 1.5 million that went to Egypt. There's another 1.5 million that went to Chad. 1.2 million went to South Sudan. I know family members, people who went to Saudi Arabia. Some people went to Kenya. So really, when you look at the migration map as a result of this war, the Sudanese citizens had to disperse in all directions just to get away from all of the carnage.
So Egypt is taking in a lot of people then.
Absolutely.
Because my friend Nico House, he went to Egypt about a year ago, and he said he was surprised to see how many refugees were in Egypt. There were even Syrian refugees in Egypt. He had mentioned that. So, it just seems like Egypt is taking in a lot of people. So this is really interesting. Thank you so much for this. The Oracle says, which group represents the indigenous Sudanese people?
I mean, they're all pretty much indigenous. But when we talk about non-indigenous, we don't want to make it seem as if these people are not Sudanese. They're Sudanese, but there are nomadic groups in Sudan. The nomadic groups go cross-border. So they would be in Sudan. They would go out, you know, a lot of them are from Chad, Niger. But the agricultural communities, the indigenous communities, like in Darfur and in the Nuba Mountains, in the far north of Sudan and the eastern part of Sudan, there's a lot of indigenous groups. The complication comes in when, you know, the Bashir regime set up this kind of pro-Arabized Sudanese agenda, where the non-Arab indigenous groups are the ones that get the brunt of the war. They suffer the most. Since the days of South Sudan, you have people in Darfur, in the Nuba Mountains, in Blue Nile State. The southern and southern western and southern southeastern parts of Sudan have historically had, you know, the worst experience when it comes to, you know, the state violence and the genocide that's been perpetrated on them.
So how can this particular issue, is there a way to solve this genocide in Sudan? And why aren't more, and this is just a question I've been having for a long time, why aren't other nations in that region pushing back against what is happening in Sudan?
Okay, so, I mean, there's two folds to this. Like, the solutions right now, there's kind of two tracks that are going. The U.S. is hosting, you know, talks between the Egypt, the Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. And they're talking strictly to the army and the RSF. to, and you know, there's some, you know, breakthrough, partial breakthrough, you know, they're talking now about what the conditions are for the ceasefire, for like a humanitarian pause and then a ceasefire. So that's going along slowly. The other track is with the African Union, bringing together all of the political actors in Sudan to have a comprehensive dialogue. So that was supposed to kick off like a few months ago. It got delayed. But most likely, if there's a breakthrough with this ceasefire, then there would be that bigger dialogue. And that's actually where the fundamental problems should be solved. So the issue of accountability is a huge one, where basically there has to be some framework of transitional justice. You know, just like a lot of African conflicts, you have to have truth and reconciliation. You have to have some sort of accountability for war crimes. You have to have some kind of rapprochement to the millions of IDPs and refugees right now return. You have to have some form of security sector reform where you have one national army instead of all of the armed groups that are in Sudan right now. So these are solutions, but they're slow solutions. But, you know, there's no way around it this time. You know, there were wars, a lot of wars in Sudan that ended in negotiations, but they ended with power sharing rather than ending with some kind of fundamental dialogue to actually see how to move forward from there and how to avoid any of these wars in the future. So these things are in their infancy stages, unfortunately. But the reason the countries around Sudan are not able to stop this is because our neighbors are at war with each other as well, unfortunately. You know, Egypt and Ethiopia have a long-standing conflict, partially to do with the GERD dam, the Renaissance dam in Ethiopia, and Egypt just outwardly hostile towards the dam, claiming that it'll affect the Nile waters. But it's more about regional influence and hegemony. You know, you have, you know, Khartoum has historically had a bad relationship with Chad. They, of course, South Sudan separated, so there's some tension over there. A bad relationship with Libya. You know, Eritrea and Ethiopia are not on the same page anymore. You know, and they're kind of weighing how this war would affect them. And it really did. The war did affect all of the neighboring countries, you know, from cross-border, you know, troop movements to, like, you know, encroachment to taking in so many refugees. So all of the countries do actually want this war to stop, but they're not agreeing among each other. You know, these are some of the problems that we have within the African Union of, you know, conflicts within that. But there's been some positive steps. Like, for example, the BRICS included both Egypt and Ethiopia into the BRICS. They added them in 2023, I think, as a way to also say that, hey, you know, we're all part of the same kind of global South. So why don't we stop the fighting and focus on development and partnerships and stuff like that? But again, you know, it didn't really, you know, show any concrete results yet. But the long arc of, you know, this conflict will end with some kind of negotiated settlement. It's just a question of how long will that take.
Okay, here's a great question here from Ancient Crustacean. Where is the foreign intelligence in this war? Is there a local side versus a native side funded by foreigners, or are both sides funded by foreign nations, or is it like Gaza and there isn't two sides, it's one side doing all the bad? That's a good question. Where is the funding coming from?
So who's at war right now? The Sudan Armed Forces against the RSF. The Sudan Armed Forces is primarily pushed by Egypt. You know, Egypt has had a, you know, since 2019, unfortunately, has had a pretty negative role in Sudan, you know, trying to solidify military rule in Sudan, but also kind of, you know, adopting SAF as their close ally. The bigger and more you know, dangerous threat is from the UAE. You know, the UAE have adopted the RSF and have been funding it since way before the war. And through the war in Yemen, they've enabled the RSF to be kind of a country within a country. So unfortunately, you know, there aren't any good actors leading the charge of the war. But know, these things change, you know, and, you know, the war, the way it's going right now, I don't see any one of these polar, you know, these leaderships as being someone, you know, people to get behind. Now, that being said, there are a lot of people who picked up arms after 2023 to defend themselves. A lot of people who got into the under the SAF umbrella to defend their areas from the RSF. So these are people that are regular citizens, and they just had to pick up arms. On the other side, the RSF, because they recruit on a tribal basis, if you're part of a tribe that's been targeted by the RSF, then your choices are very clear. Either you join the RSF or you get bulldozed by them. You know, so they're like, all right, yeah.
Go ahead. Is the RSF?
It's the Rapid Support Forces. These are who used to be the Janjaweed in the 2000s. And then during the Bashir regime, they kind of gave them a proper name of the Rapid Support Forces. This is the main militia that's committing the atrocities right now in Darfur.
Okay. That's good to know, because I think that this is very different, because like when we talk about the genocide that's happening in Gaza, it's a little bit more straightforward, whereas with Sudan, it's a little bit different because there's different groups, as you were referring to there. The Oracle says, so the Sudanese of Arab descent are the groups perpetuating the genocide with the assistance of the UAE and other U.S.-aligned actors?
Yeah, so the whole Arab thing in Sudan is pretty convoluted. You know what I mean? And if you want to look at it that way, both sides have an Arab supremacist undertone to all of their ideology, their movements, their alliances, and everything. So historically, it was both sides that committed the genocide in Darfur. It was both sides that committed the genocides in the Nuba Mountains and in the Blue Nile and these places. So it's actually the same Arab supremacy that got split into two right now. Now, that being said, a lot of non-Arab groups have joined the different sides. Some of them have joined the RSF and some of them have joined SAF. So it's not strictly right now along those ethnic lines. It's more about kind of, you know, geography and alliances right now. But that is a common denominator between SAF and RSF. You know, the policies that they follow and the genocides that were committed by both of them. You know, 2023 is just them kind of disagreeing on who's going to take the bigger piece of the pie when it comes to Sudan.
This is insane. Why do you feel more corporate media outlets are not discussing this?
I think because of how complicated it is, number one. Number two, there's no clear, you know, good guys and bad guys, you know, the way the media usually likes to put it in a certain box where it's like, okay, who do we root for? You know, and it just doesn't fit that module. But the other part of it, the corporate media doesn't cover it. Because both sides, when you follow the money, it goes back to this U.S.-Israel alliance in the region. You know, Sudan's been pushed into this place and been shoved into the Middle East, even though when you look at Sudanese, you can't tell us apart from our African neighbors at all. You know, I could be mistaken for an Ethiopian. A Western Sudan might be mistaken for a Chadian. You know, people in the Nuba Mountains might be mistaken for South Sudanese. Even people in the north are Nubians, and they belong to indigenous black groups. So it's like the insistence of including Sudan into this Western Asia, so-called Middle East fold is kind of also one of the things that broke the country and, you know, led to kind of what we're seeing right now.
This is really interesting. Again, I just feel like still a lot of people don't know about this because, you know, it's been happening in the Congo as well. Margaret Kimberly came onto the show to discuss this a while back about genocide in the Congo. Israel had its hand in that as well with the mining, which I discussed before on the show. But I just think that, again, it's just either highly suppressed. But when it comes to corporate media, they're not really discussing this the way that they should. It's alarming.
of my life, does everything with a smile. She's my mother, my sweet mother. She can take the pain away with just one look. That's my mother, my sweet mother. You're the picture in the frame with all the colors of the rainbow. I'm far from ashamed to say I love you so. And here I lay at home tonight. It's late but I can't sleep tonight. Forgive me if I take my time, but I just have to let you know you're so special. She taught me how to pray. We play games every day with my mother, my sweet mother. Even if I made no sense, you listen with patience. That's my mother, my sweet mother. She would sing a sweet song till I shut my eyes and kiss my head and say goodnight. And I feel safe with you by my side. You're there for every step in my life. I'm sorry if my love is unkind. I just have to let you know you're so precious. If only this was true. I'm in a cold, dark, wet room. I was an orphan, and now I'm 22. I've never known my mom. A picture faded by the sun is all I have. I'm left alone with nothing more but what I am. It's not enough that life is tough when there's no one to call my mother, my sweet mother, my sweet mother.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Tawakkul of the Fighter. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on I'm British Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And so obviously the title was Tawakkul of the Fighter, but I'm going to also refer this to, you know, our normal daily lives. But obviously when we look at the lives of the martyrs, we see such beautiful examples. And look, when it comes to Tawakkul, apart from obviously our greatest role models, our imams, so all the infallibles, our imams, all the prophets and the holy prophet, and the Ahl Bayt, all the Ahl Bayt, then obviously we look at the lives of the martyrs, we get some really nice sort of practical lessons. We see how they behaved in particular situations. And, you know, obviously, so let's see what we can derive, for example, from the life story of one of the famous martyrs of the Holy Defense. And this is Shahid Muhammad Ibrahim Hemat, for example. So there's a story about him visiting with some others, Imam Khomeini in Tehran, and they were all sitting there on the floor, and suddenly a really strong gust of wind blew a window open or shut and shattered the glass. And obviously everyone sort of jumped, but at that point in time, so Imam Khomeini was not at all scared. And Hemat, I think, saw this, that, you know, that Imam Khomeini did not jump. And but what Imam Khomeini then did jump at, in a sense, was when he heard the call to prayer. Imam Khomeini immediately moved and took leave of absence from the group so he could go and pray. So obviously, so there's two important things here. So it's obviously no fear of these sort of slightly unusual things that happen in our world, but fear of Allah. and obviously getting to prayer on time. Welcome back to A to Z here on I'm Being Betrayed with me, Sister Zainab. And so obviously I've just given an example from of Tawakkul, and actually so I've used the story of when a famous martial law defender, Shahid Muhammad Ibrahim Hemmat, visited with Imam Khomeini and observed Imam Khomeini's fearlessness in terms of being fearless of the worldly environment, but then his fear with regard to Allah and pleasing Allah and praying immediately on the upon the call to prayer. So you know, there's some things we can take both. We need to take both things on board. So obviously the one thing is, how close can we get to this this attitude that we're fearless of things around us? And look, for sure, you've probably been somewhere and there was a sudden loud noise. Maybe you're just walking along the street and suddenly hear a car behind you, or you do indeed just hear a door slam shut, and it's possible that you yourself have sort of also just sort of jumped suddenly. You know, many of us have that behavior that if a sudden noise occurs, and these are just sort of reflexes almost, these are our instincts. But imagine to yourself that, you know, there are people who have trained their fearlessness in our worldly environment to such an extent that they don't even jump at these things. They're so calm. Nothing sort of, and the word I would use is, nothing phases them. Nothing sort of disrupts their serenity, their calmness. And the other side, obviously, here is, are we sort of generating in ourselves this real fear of Allah in terms of wanting to please Allah and sort of really praying on time? And this, again, is something that I leave open to you, to all the listeners. And this is something that we can, inshallah, tackle individually. And I pray that everyone is successful in that. And that was it for today. And I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A2Z here on I'm Being Betrayed. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
May the peace, blessings, and mercy of God be with you all. The interests of colonial powers in our countries date back a long time, as we have explained on numerous occasions. However, in terms of trade, after the conclusion of the Napoleonic campaigns and wars in 1815, European commerce made an unprecedented inroad into the Arab East and North Africa. Local societies were self-sufficient, but with the advent of commercial incursions and the presence of European capital, our economies became integrated into the global economic system in a detrimental way. As dependent economies, supplying raw materials and consuming European manufactured goods. According to the book, A History of Modern Middle East, by American historians William Cleveland and Martin Panton. This point is crucial for understanding the European colonial plan to conquer Western Asia since the days of the Ottoman Empire, aiming to weaken it from within by tying it to the global economy and making it financially and economically dependent. After the fall of the Ottoman Empire, Western capitalism divided our territories, which it referred to as the Middle East, with the goal of securing trade routes, raw materials, and new markets for the expanding global economy dominated by Europe, according to the same authors. The control of oil, essential for fueling expanding capitalist economies, became the central focus of Western competition in the region, and the primary motivation for establishing and maintaining political and economic dominance over our countries. According to American sociologist Bert Pilbaruglu in his book, The Turmoil in the Middle East, Imperialism, War, and Political Instability, Britain aimed to redraw the borders of the Levant in North Africa in a way that would allow it to control strategically important areas, such as southern Iraq due to its oil reserves, and Egypt because of the Suez Canal, which serves as a gateway to Asian colonies, particularly India. Iran, due to its oil wealth, was also a primary target of Western plans. Lord Curzon, the British governor of India from 1899 to 1905, stated that Persia was one of the key pieces on the board of global domination. Almost half a century later, in 1953, Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh made the decision to nationalize the country's oil. Britain and the United States then collaborated to orchestrate a coup against him, which solidified the Shah's regime and Western influence in Iran until the Islamic Revolution's triumph in 1979. How did the interests of the United States and neocolonialism arise during the interwar period? Oil and its vast reserves in the Arab region were the driving force behind American imperialism. We already mentioned that European commercial interests began to manifest themselves in our territories at the beginning of the 19th century. This raises the question, when did American ambitions and neocolonialism begin to emerge in our countries? The answer lies in the period between the two world wars, specifically from 1918 to 1939. Once again, oil and its vast reserves in Arab countries were the main driving force behind American imperialism. Controlling this strategic resource was essential for the United States' dominance over the global economy, especially after World War II. One of the key reasons for expanding American influence was to contain communism, similar to how Iranian influence is viewed as a threat today. After World War II, several West Asian countries that gained independence implemented policies focused on local development, raised the prices of exported raw materials, and limited both imports and foreign investment. The United States, on its part, viewed these economic independence policies as a threat. It needed raw materials at low prices to sustain its productive capacity and commercial advantages, and it sought to increase its investments in the region. Thus, it decided to become increasingly involved in the policies of Southeast Asia and West Asia, the area it refers to the Middle East and North Africa, as detailed by American historian Henry Heller in his book, The Cold War and the New Imperialism. In this work, he specifically mentions the U.S. intervention in Iran, 1953, and Lebanon, 1958, as well as the pressure exerted by its French and British allies during the Suez Crisis, 1956. It also points out that in 1957, there was a direct intervention through the proclamation of the Eisenhower Doctrine, which established the right of the United States to intervene militarily to ensure the security of any West Asian country threatened by communist subversion. To summarize how this structure of hegemony operates in practice, there are five interconnected tools. First, the presence of local regimes subordinate to the United States. Second, military bases. Third, economic and financial policies along with privatization and the application of sanctions when necessary. Fourth, indirect interventions, coups, and the encouragement of civil wars. Fifth, the control of energy supply chains and waterways such as the Strait of Hormuz, the Bab el-Mandeb Canal, and the Suez Canal, along with their infrastructure, pipelines, ports, terminals. Currently, there is a new colonial offensive in the region. The fate of the Arab regimes is in the hands of the United States, and many of them have fully integrated into the Western system, as stated in one of his interviews by the late Lebanese economist, thinker, and Minister of Finance, George Quorum. In light of the above, some may argue that the primary concern of the West is not the colonial structure, but rather the protection of Israel. Those who make this argument often base it on the influence of the Israeli lobby in Washington, claiming that it shapes political decisions in the United States and other Western capitals. Our response is that the influence of the Israeli lobby is indeed real, just as is the case with the Christian Zionist movement in the United States, whose religious beliefs advocate for the establishment of a Jewish national homeland in Palestine. However, both the lobby and the movement operate within a broader strategic framework defined by the logic of colonialism. Israel, therefore, serves as a tool of colonialism rather than an end itself. A clear example of the limited power of the Israeli lobby can be seen in the 1956 war, the tripartite aggression by Britain, France, and Israel against Egypt. At that time, Washington urges its allies to withdraw from Egyptian territory and halt the offensive, as its main priority was to strengthen the international order under its leadership and safeguard trade flows, preventing the resurgence of the old European empires. In other words, when Israel's tactics clash with the system's structure, the logic of American colonialism takes precedence. This colonialism, both European and American, continues to have interests in our countries and aims to strengthen them. Changes in the global geopolitical dynamics have given the United States a decisive advantage in this process. The United States and its allies will continue to treat our countries as incapable of self-governance, of developing public institutions, of formulating economic policies that align with social interests, and of protecting themselves against what they call Iranian expansion or the rise of Chinese influence. According to this perspective, our countries will still require the oversight of the powers from the Northwest. The presence of a dominant class in all Arab countries allied with colonialism and serving its interests within state administrations means that oil production has not been disrupted in West Asia. Trade routes remain strategic and raw materials continue to be exploited, and investment interests have not ceased. Now more than ever, these countries are closely linked to international security. Western Asia, North Africa, the Arab world, and their surrounding regions serve as the gateway to the Indian and Pacific Oceans. This is how the West views us, and there are three crucial maritime routes for global trade: the Strait of Hormuz, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, and the Suez Canal. These three strategic passages highlight that the West, led by the United States, is determined to dominate our countries in military, political, economic, and all other aspects. Their desire for domination is not directly linked to Israel, even though it acts as a tool to facilitate this hegemony. It also does not depend on the decisions of the people, the existence of forces fighting against Israel, or the presence